Hello, and welcome to the Netzer Investor podcast. I'm Atharva Deshmukh, the head of research for Netzer Investor. Today's episode is all about blended finance. And to explain why, let me point out a brief article that I wrote a few weeks ago, which is about a fund called Tides. Now, Tides is a fund put together by Camco, an asset manager. It's about $100 million in size, and it's aimed at financing renewable energy projects in the Pacific Islands. It is backed by governments in the UK and New Zealand, and about 20% of its capital will come from government donors in the form of junior equity. The remaining, split between debt and senior equity, will be financed by private investors. So funds like Tides fall under the category of blended finance, which, as the name suggests, blends public and private capital into a financing instrument. And these instruments have become increasingly popular in climate solutions investing, particularly in emerging markets. So in this episode, I thought we could explore how blended finance instruments are facilitating the energy transition, what the limitations are, and what the future holds for blended finance. Joining us today is a very special guest, is Joanne Larrea, the CEO of Convergence, a global network for blended finance that is backed by governments across the world. Its membership includes both private investors and governments. And Joan has led Convergence since its inception in 2015. Joan, welcome to the podcast. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you very much for having me. Looking forward to having this conversation.
Thank you. So I was reading up a bit about the origins of Convergence, and I found it really interesting that it traces back to a July 2015 announcement made in Addis Ababa, Ethiopia, which is where the third International Conference on Financing for Development was convened. And to, I guess, introduce Convergence to our audience, I have a couple of questions about July 2015. One, at the time, to quote Victor Hugo, was blended finance an idea whose time had come? And on a more personal note for you, Joan, what was it about blended finance back then that motivated you to lead this new initiative?
Ah, good questions. First of all, I wasn't there at the inception in 2015. I was there as we became operational in 2016. So this was not my great idea. This was a whole bunch of other people's idea that came to fruition. And I think at that moment, it was an idea whose time to get organized had come. In other words, people like me were doing blended finance for years and years and years beforehand without the actual tag. And I had done a lot of transactions in China where before you could even invest, you had to help the entrepreneur figure out a few things to make themselves investable, where the town where you were working needed some help beyond the transaction at hand. All these different moments where you needed an intersection of public money, grant money, something that wasn't seeking return, and return-seeking capital, both at the table. You needed both elements there. So what appealed to me about this company that didn't quite exist in a field that didn't quite exist was I thought that the field should exist. And if you walk around, you will find other people with experiences like mine. Oh yeah, we had a grant from Rockefeller, didn't realize that's what we were doing back then. You know, and my experience is not unique. This has been going on for a long time. I think Convergence has put shape and form and focus to the field, right? You can now look up our data and see where it happens, who's doing it, why they're doing it, and so forth. But it was already going on. What we want to do is get it to scale at this point.
Before we dig into the topic for today, which I guess is climate blended finance, maybe we could go over the big picture. So one, why is blended finance an attractive investment option for institutional investors? And could you give us a sense of its global footprint? Is the market larger in some countries than others?
It is or should be attractive to institutional investors where blended finance produces opportunities that are correct for that crowd, right? So they need to be risk-adjusted, appropriate return-seeking opportunities. So to the extent that the blending produces an investable product, then it gets interesting. And if that is true, I think the attraction is that you have an enormous part of the world that's not always investable for institutional investors, but should be attractive. It's uncorrelated returns in high growth economies. It's just not touchable without blending sometimes. So to me, blending provides a bridge for some investors to walk over to get to. I mean, just to give you examples, you got 600 million people in Africa who are not yet electrified. That's an opportunity. Renewable energy is investable. These countries may not always be investable. Let's get something going that is appealing to this crowd. I can give you other examples, but blended finance should be interesting, not for the blend, but for what the blend produces in terms of a tier inside a transaction that is actually digestible.
And what about the scale of the market currently? Where is it at?
Yeah, the scale of the market. We saw some interesting things happen in our most recent State of Blended Finance report. We produce, by the way, two per year, one of which is totally focused on climate blended finance. In our most recent one, we saw a big jump in the entire field from 2022. It was $8 billion, $8 billion with a B, to $18 billion US dollars. It's a huge jump. And the global footprint hasn't changed much. The number of transactions in Africa is always higher than other regions, followed by Asia, followed by Latin America. Dollar value is different. African transactions can often be smaller. We saw in 2023, this big jump was really interesting for a couple of reasons. First of all, official development aid, the public side you mentioned, didn't go up. It's flatlined. And what did go up was the amount of money that development banks and the private sector were putting into these transactions. You could look at that as an efficiency gain. The other interesting thing was we had several really large transactions. We kind of call them whales. You know, they swim by and they're really much bigger than all the other fish in the ocean. And those whale transactions almost single-handedly as a group moved the field into that bigger number. We also saw the median size, so forgetting the whales for a second, the median size of transactions increased, so that whereas the number of transactions over $100 million had been in the teens and popped up to 40% of the field. When I say transactions, by the way, just for your audience, for us, we capture that moment where there's an intersection between the non-commercial capital and the commercial capital. That can be at a fund level, right? You can have a junior tier of equity in a fund like you described, Tides, which then goes on to do 100 little transactions, but we would only capture the one fund. We also capture securitizations, project financings, sustainability-linked bonds, and other things. So when I say transaction or deal, it's a mixed bag. I just want to make sure I'm clear there.
And I guess to steer us into the climate territory of things, when did climate blended finance emerge within this broader market? And what's the current scale of that particular segment today?
Thank you for asking that. So first of all, in that same year that I'm talking about now, 80% of the money was in climate related things. It is huge. And you might notice I said we produce two states of blended finance reports every year. It's because we noticed that the incidence of climate as a theme in blended finance is so huge. And going back, it's always been pretty big. It's been around 40, 50, 60% of the field year on year. And that big increase in the most recent year we measured was actually all around climate. So my hunch is it's been there the whole time. And let me back up a second. If you look at what sectors, what industrial sectors blended finance shows up in, first and foremost, the financial world. Right? Transactions that have to do with financial inclusion or other things of that sort. And then renewable energy, and then agriculture or agribusiness, you know, food chains, food security. And that too is climate related. So if you think about the top two or three segments, they're all pretty climate, you know, intertwined.
And what about the investors? I mean, in climate blended finance, what's the blend usually of public and private investors?
Not enough private. So look, blended finance has a ways to go in really optimizing that very, very scarce resource, which is the non-commercial money, in order to get the commercial money to the table. Larger transactions tend to mobilize a higher proportion of commercial money than smaller transactions. And there's a lot going on under that story. If you look at Tides, what they're trying to do takes more soft money to get done than does a billion-dollar transaction. So the blend is not perfect yet. We see a lot of potential for donors organizing their side of the equation to help make the field more standardized and to help everybody have more even access to this kind of money. And on the commercial side of the house, people need to get more educated on what is possible. If you go and you talk to a BlackRock or an Apollo, they may not even realize that all of this stuff is possible. So we have work to do on both sides of the house.
And this report you mentioned, the climate edition of the State of Blended Finance report, one of the things that I found interesting was it actually makes the case that private sector financing has been on the rise. Median investment size, fund flow, both of these are up. What, in your view, might be driving this growth? And is that growth going to stay going forward?
Well, the mitigation side is highly investable. So if you are an institutional investor and you are willing to think about doing anything in one of our markets, emerging economies of the world, that is a known asset class, right? So that's a huge part of the equation. You also have regulatory drivers back in Europe, for example, that ask financial institutions and others to look at their, you know, scope 3 emissions and to look at their supply chains. And that regulatory push has been really helpful as well, because it brings attention to the world of climate investing. So there are a few drivers at work here. It really, really is a sweet spot, because both, if you think about what blended finance needs, you have to have an interested public sector participant saying, I'm willing to put money behind this. It is not commercial. I might not get any money back. It might just be a grant. That means you're going to be looking for high impact. You're buying impact with that money. And so climate is a huge, it's an existential issue for all of us. And so development actors are highly, highly interested. On the other side, you have commercial investors saying, hey, some of this is investable. And I have a regulatory push behind me. I really need to look at it. So that's where what brought us to today. Now we can talk about what the future looks like, because I think it might look a little different.
Right. And you mentioned mitigation. And I guess broadly speaking, think about the other theme, which is adaptation. And this report you mentioned also talks about this thing called cross-cutting transactions. So I was wondering, could you tell us more about what cross-cutting transactions are and the degree of investor confidence in these deals?
Yeah, first of all, adaptation needs much more attention. If you take certain regions of the world, they don't have a mitigation problem. They don't have massive coal-fired power plants or oil industries, whatever. They need energy and they need protection from weather events. They're highly vulnerable. So adaptation needs huge amounts of investment and is not getting the attention it needs. You also asked about cross-cutting transactions. So what we have noticed is sometimes a transaction just happens to handle both sides of the equation. It may be something that has to do with grid resiliency, which would be both resiliency, which is adaptation, and renewable energy. So sometimes things just don't fit in neat boxes. And that's particularly true in, say, agriculture. You may have the ability to reduce deforestation in an agriculture transaction or an agribusiness transaction. And that also may very well help protect from an adaptation point of view. So we just notice that there are, you know, what we're trying to do, we look at public sources. Let me back up and explain where our data comes from. We look at public sources, reliable things like press releases from the principals involved in a transaction. And we read what we can to see, is it blended? First, to be blended, you have to have somebody doing something on a non-commercial basis. Secondly, what does it sound like that the strategy was trying to approach? And then we try to put it into our database in the correct way. But things cross different definitional lines. So there is definitely a set of deals that isn't purely adaptation or purely mitigation. It's not because somebody set out to do that. It's just the nature of the transaction. It was a hard to describe transaction.
The related investment theme the report talks about is nature-based solutions. Could you explain why a blended finance structure lends itself well to investments in nature-based solutions?
I would flip your question around. Why does a nature-based solution, a nature-based transaction often need blending? And the answer lies in, you know, if I'm a commercial investor, and I've been one, this is a part of my own history. You're looking for a revenue line, and you're trying to understand what the risks are to that revenue line, and is this a decent investment or not? It's harder in the nature-based space to tell somebody how they're going to make money. How do you make money protecting a mangroves, a coastline full of mangroves? How do you make money making a town more resilient or infrastructure more resilient? You know, how do you attach a dollar value to any of that? And so with blending, you have one party at least who is not operating on commercial principles and is possibly able, therefore, to take what was an externality, a public good, and turn it into an internal part of a deal. And I can give you a couple examples. If you look at debt for nature swaps or debt for X, Y, and Z swaps, they all have a similar thought process, which is you get a consortium of parties, some of whom are commercial, some of whom are not. So collectively, their pricing is going to be better than another consortium. And that consortium goes up, and I'm going to put it in layman's terms for a second, goes up and buys the sovereign debt of a nation that has a high debt burden and B, a natural resource worth protecting or very important to protect. And if that consortium buys that sovereign debt and restructures it to be more affordable and inserts new clauses, be they covenants or other things, that require the sovereign government to do things for that resource, that coral reef or its fisheries reserves. Now you have a nature-based structure where investors in that bond or investors in that sovereign debt have a decent return, and you have positive activity that's going to happen for that coral reef or for that fishery zone or whatever it is. So these debt for nature swaps all have that element of inserting binding constraints and also, by the way, providing the funding for it, right? So all these debt for nature swaps also provide a budget for the government to go out and do what the activity is. So that's one way that you can create an investable nature-based transaction. We also see sustainability-linked bonds where bondholders agree to forego their coupon for a few years, and that money goes instead to a government to engage in some sustainability activity that has a measurable outcome. If the outcome is hit, the bondholders get a little bit more of a payout than they would have gotten otherwise. So they are, in a sense, invested in the outcome, and the government in that case has the budget to go ahead and try to achieve the outcome. A third example would be insurance products. Insurance is very, very good at pricing risk. And so to the extent that an adaptation activity or a nature-focused activity can reduce risk to a coastline or to a community and can be reflected in the price of insurance, that's interesting. Now, not enough of these products exist. I think there is a role for the development agencies or the philanthropies of the world to step forward and try to figure out how to do it, how to price it, and perhaps to buy down the cost of that insurance. So there's a whole bunch of stuff there, but it's not easy peasy project finance like a renewables project is. You know, a renewables project is essentially a very, very old financial technology paired with a fairly young physical technology. But this stuff I'm talking about, this nature-based stuff, it takes a lot of creativity to come up with an asset class that people understand and a revenue line that they understand.
Now we've talked about a bit of the tailwinds that are pushing blended finance along. Let's, I guess, pivot now to the headwinds. The obvious elephant in the room being increasing policy uncertainty and policy reversals coming in from the US. Does this affect the climate blended finance market at all?
Yeah, remember that blended finance is the intersection often of development flows, development aid flows, and foreign direct investment flows. And both of those are hitting headwinds. So I think on the ODA side, the official development aid side, the total of official development aid out there in any given year has been about $230 billion, of which a very, 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 very small proportion goes into blended finance. The entire field of blended finance is $18 billion, right? So there's very, very small flows of ODA into blended finance. ODA is probably going to drop at $50 or $60 billion a year. Now, within official development aid, working with the financial sector and working with the private sector is probably going to be more of a flavor of the day than it normally is. So the relative intensity of focus on blended finance or using official development money for blended finance will probably go up a bit, but the overall tide is going the other direction. So that's the official development aid side. Foreign direct investment in any time of uncertainty, and we are in a time of serious uncertainty right now, FDI tends to drop. So I'm not saying all is lost, but I am saying I think blended finance that supports local investment, development of local capital markets, enabling of the home country government to get a lot more done on its own, I think that will be important. And getting incredibly efficient with what scarce development or catalytic money there is will be really important.
And another set of criticisms for blended finance was pointed out by this blog written by Mariana Mazzucato, who's a professor at UCL. And her concern is that blended finance has, quote, fallen short of its promise and fund flows have stagnated. And you recently wrote a blog addressing some of the points she raised, which I found really interesting. Could you talk us through your response to her concerns?
Yes. So first of all, I really like to keep a really tight definition about what we're talking about. Blended finance is not anytime anybody in the public sector intersects with anybody in the private sector. We only measure at Convergence, because of why we were established, we only measure transactions in which there is catalytic money not operating on market principles and private sector money. That's a pretty small part of the field. So the idea that blended finance of that sort was going to step into a trillion-dollar hole was, I think, misguided from the start. Blended finance was always supposed to be a piece of a mosaic and not a silver bullet. In fact, I think she uses the word silver bullet. I swear if you were to Google convergence and silver bullet, you will only ever find us saying blended finance is not a silver bullet. Literally, we say that in every educational piece we do, in every capacity training we do, it's never our statement that it is a silver bullet. It is always our statement that it can't be the whole party. So I think blended finance, you could set it up as a straw man and say, oh, it didn't cure everything, and therefore it has failed. And I think that is an unfair start to a conversation. Also, the idea that it's stagnated. It has bopped along at about $14, $15 billion a year for a while, but it jumped the year in which we were last looking at it. So that's not quite accurate either. Another issue I think where I differ from her view is the idea that I think she said the public sector should lead and shape markets. Fair enough. The public sector in any country is the representative voice of the people of that country. And that is a totally fair comment in setting the table and setting the rules and setting the boundaries and signaling where that country wants to go. But I don't think we can wait for another three generations of people to grow up for the public sector to get something done, especially in places where the government is really, really, really constrained. Do you really want another three generations of little Ugandan girls to grow up and age out and not have opportunities? I don't. I want to capture this generation and its potential. So that means all hands on deck. Sure. Public sector, we need that voice, we need that the guardrails, we need the rule set. And private sector, we need that money. We need that money working in these places as fast as we can get it. So I just don't think you can choose an either or response to a situation like this. To me, it's all hands on deck. And by the way, it has long not been the case that either the government in any of these emerging economies or the MDBs and the multilateral development banks, the development finance institutions, neither of them has been the majority of the money for a very long time. And for us to pretend that between them they can figure out everything is missing the boat. The private sector is enormous. There was what, $300 trillion circulating in the private sector, in investment capital. That's where the money is. Let's figure out if any small fraction of it can get interested in investing in these places and being, a part of the solution. I just don't think you can exclude one channel and focus only on the other. There needs to be a balance.
On that note, and to draw this conversation to a close, I guess, I wanted to come back to the title of your blog, which was Blended Finance Isn't Perfect, But It's Essential. So looking ahead, do you believe that climate blended finance will continue to be essential? And if it isn't perfect, what needs to change?
It will be essential. I think there's a lot that can be done without any blending whatsoever, and the private sector can gallop off and go do it. Renewable energy in many, many cases is totally commercial. Go do that. Let's not spend any public resources on it. But there's an awful lot of other stuff where the market signal is not there. There are externalities. It's not possible to put these transactions together in the short term without some kind of collaboration between public impact seeking or development outcome seeking actors and the hard commercial money. So let's figure that stuff out too. In the striving toward perfect, and nobody ever hits perfect, right? But in the striving toward perfect, there are a few things we need to do. Scale and standardization are two of those things. For an institutional investor to look at an opportunity, it has to look kind of like an opportunity in Cleveland or Frankfurt, right? It can't look radically different. They need to be able to recognize it in an instant. Oh, this is one of those, and act accordingly. So scale matters. These are folks who need to write $100 million checks and don't want to be more than 20% of the transaction. So can we please come up with more blended finance transactions that operate at scale? That's one issue. The other one is standardization. If every donor insists that their specific issue be factored into every transaction, and each of them optimized for all those issues, we're not going to get there. If every donor has very specific rules around the use of their money in terms of, is it a guarantee or is it a first loss, or is it equity, or is it a grant? We're like cobblers in the shop making one shoe at a time. We need to figure out, you know, the industrialization, if you will, in some cases. I would love it if some elements of blended finance behaved like my old world of project finance, where, okay, you're going to do a deal and you all flip to page 20 because, you know, the first 20 pages of the term sheet is all definitions. And everybody knows that in a project financing for a power plant, for example, you have an offtake agreement, you've got an operations and management agreement, you've got a tariff you need to discuss, you've got an engineering procurement and construction contract. Everybody knows the basic building blocks and you start on page 20 of the conversation. We need more blended finance to work like that, where everybody flips to page 20 and goes, okay, this is a blended fund. This is how much concessional money is needed. And these are the terms on that concessional money. In the waterfall, it will be treated this way because that's the way we always do it. Maybe we tweak it a bit, but let's move on with and get down to brass tacks. We need that Henry Ford moment. You know, you can have any car you want as long as it's black, I think was how the Model A came about. We need more Model A's happening and Model T's, and, you know, let's move the whole thing forward at scale and in a standardized manner.
So scale, standardization, and all hands on deck. I think that's a great note to bring this episode to a close. To our listeners, thank you for joining in. Thank you for tuning in. I hope you enjoyed this episode. If you did, please share it with your peers, share it on LinkedIn, tag us, and write something about it. And Joan, thank you for joining us and sharing your insights and what was a very interesting discussion. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much for having me.